This evening I want to begin my sermon in a way that is very similar to the way I began my sermon this morning, and that is to draw our attention to the person of our great God and to contemplate who He is. And it's never a bad thing to think about our God, is it? We can never think about Him too much, can we? And to just meditate upon who He is, His greatness, and of course His greatness is displayed in many different ways. You think about the greatness of His love, the greatness of His power, the greatness of His sovereignty, the greatness of His grace and kindness and compassion. We can spend so much time focusing upon who God is, and that's a good thing. And this evening, of all the many aspects of God's character that we could direct our attention toward this evening, I want us to focus on two in particular. And to begin with, I'd like us to focus on the fact that our God is a jealous God. He is a jealous God. And keep in mind, God's jealousy is far different than sinful human jealousy. Usually whenever we think of the word jealous, maybe it's a bad connotation because of bad experiences or a bad thought about jealousy and the way that displays itself. But as we think about the jealousy of God, we realize, even as I touched upon this morning, there is only one true and living God. There are many other so-called gods, but they are not really gods at all, are they? There's only one true and living God. Yes, people worship other gods, but God demands that people worship Him and Him alone. God alone is worthy of worship. And men and women must worship God and no one else. And if anyone dares to worship anyone or anything besides God, God in His jealousy will really defend His own honor and His own name. And oftentimes we see God's jealousy acting out against individuals that are not worshiping Him. Now, as we consider Israel and the law that God gave Israel, we read this in Exodus 20, no doubt a familiar passage for us. I believe I referred to that this morning as well. Verses 4 to 6, we read this in Exodus 20. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image, or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself unto them, nor serve them, for I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children, unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me, and showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. There in verse 5, the Lord proclaims, I am a jealous God. Now, as Israel took possession of the promised land, they were not to go and worship the gods that the people of those lands worshipped. They weren't to worship the gods of the Amorites. The altars of those false gods were to be destroyed. We read this in Exodus 34, verses 13 and 14. But ye shall destroy their altars, break their images, cut down their groves, for thou shalt worship no other god, for the Lord, whose name is Jealous, is a jealous God. We think about the many names of God. Here is one that we don't think of as often, perhaps. God's name is Jealous. As we read about the children of Israel and how they were reminded even before they entered the promised land in the book of Deuteronomy, we read this. Take heed unto yourselves, lest ye forget the covenant of the Lord your God, which He made with you, and make a graven image, or the likeness of anything which the Lord thy God hath forbidden thee. For the Lord thy God is a consuming fire, even a jealous God. Now we could go to other passages as well. Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 9. Deuteronomy 6, 15. We could go to Joshua 24, 19. And we could read much the same thing about God's jealousy. There should be no doubt in our minds, God is a jealous God. And as I mentioned already, His jealousy is not tainted with sin, as is human jealousy oftentimes. God's jealousy is a holy jealousy. Yes, God alone is God. He is the only one that deserves to be worshipped. And God rightfully demands of His children that they worship Him and Him alone. And when they forsake Him, when they worship others, then His jealousy is inflamed, even as it's described in one of our passages here, in Deuteronomy 4. The Lord thy God is a consuming fire, even a jealous God. God takes action to defend His name. There should be no doubt at all in our mind, God is a jealous God. He is a flaming fire. And who would dare to provoke such a God as this? Who would even think of wronging one who is known as the jealous one? But yet, how many sinners do indeed provoke God to jealousy? They provoke him to anger. There are many that turn to other gods and worship them instead of worshiping the true God. And even those that don't turn to outright idolatry, as far as what we would consider idolatry, worshiping graven images, there are so many that make choices that far from please God. There are many that test God. There are many that think, well, I can make demands of God. And to think such things is foolishness indeed, isn't it? As we find time and time again, even as we read through the scriptures, or even as we consider, you know, human history, time and time again, sinners have tested God. They've questioned him. They've put their own demands, their own stipulations upon God, even for conditions for their own obedience to God. And that's foolishness. That doesn't make any sense. Now, we'd think whenever people would do something like this, they'd say to God, in essence, well, I will obey you if. You'd think that God would become angry right away, not put up with such things. But what do we find oftentimes in the scriptures? Yes, we've just seen that God is a jealous God. He is a consuming fire. But not only is God a jealous God, but he is also a forbearing God. He is a God who is patient. He is slow to anger. And God many times responds to the weakness of his people and the foolishness of his people with patience and forbearance. And aren't you thankful for that? Because all of us have found ourselves in a place, as we think to the past and even looking ahead to the future, we're going to make choices and we're going to relate to God that is not the best, you know, and we're going to make foolish choices, and we may even put conditions to God. And instead of God becoming angry with us, God many times will be patient and long-suffering. He will forbear. And at times he'll even go along with our conditions, even though that is foolish of us to do such a thing. It's this aspect of God's forbearance that we want to direct our attention now for just a little while. Yes, God is a jealous God. And even in the same passage that we referred to earlier, Exodus 34, we read this in verses 6 and 7. And the Lord passed before him and proclaimed, the Lord God, merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abundant in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, and that will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children's children, unto the third and the fourth generations. So you see this, verse 6 of Exodus 34, God is long-suffering. He is patient. We go to the book of Psalms, Psalm 86 and verse 15. But thou, O Lord, art a God full of compassion and gracious, long-suffering, and plenteous in mercy and truth. And then let me show you a passage in the New Testament, Romans 2 and verse 4. Or despisest thou the riches of his goodness and forbearance and long-suffering, not knowing that the goodness of God leadeth thee to repentance? So God, with great patience, with great forbearance, puts up with sinners and their sinfulness, and his desire is for the lost that they would come to know Jesus. And even for redeemed sinners, they make foolish choices too, don't they? But yet God oftentimes forbears. He's patient. He's slow to anger. One more passage here, Psalm 103, verse 8. The Lord is merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and plenteous in mercy. You go to many other passages, but you get the idea. God is long-suffering. He is forbearing. He is slow to anger. So as he deals with this fallen creation, a creation that is far from perfect, he puts up with a lot from people, even from people like you and I. As we turn to the book of Judges this evening, we want to consider the jealousy and forbearance of God. And it's made quite clear as we turn to Judges chapter 6, verses 25 through 40. We see from Gideon's life and the things that were going on at a certain period of time in his life that God shows himself to be a jealous God, but also we see God being a forbearing God. Judges chapter 6, verses 25 through 40. I invite you to turn there with me in your Bibles, or if you're using one of our pew Bibles, it's page 283. but Judges chapter 6. And just to fill in, we're jumping in the middle of the chapter. It's a rather lengthy chapter. So last week, I preached through about halfway, and we're going to pick up where we left off last time. But just to refresh our memories concerning last week's sermon, and even what we considered in the previous 24 verses of Judges chapter 6, the chapter begins with a note that the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. Of course, that's a repeating pattern for the Israelites. And in this case, God delivered the sinful Israelites, the rebellious Israelites, into the hand of the Midianites. For 7 years, the Midianites oppressed them. As we read through the passage, it seems that after Israel planted their crops, and those crops started to grow, and perhaps as it neared harvest time, that is when the Midianites and their allies, we have the Amalekites, the children of the east, they descend upon the land. And it's not as if there's just a few of them. It's numbering like grasshoppers for multitude. And just like grasshoppers devour everything green and perhaps even things brown in its sight, the Midianites totally devastated the land. And whenever these Midianites and their allies came upon the land, the children of Israel abandoned their homes. They fled to the mountains and to the caves and to the dens that they had prepared there out in the boondocks, we could say, out in the wilderness or out in the mountains, the caves. These Midianites were fearful people. They were they aroused fear within the people. They left a wave of destruction behind them. And whenever they finally left for a season, Israel was impoverished. And think of this happening not just 1 year, but year after year after year. And it's because of this destruction, it's because of this impoverishment that Israel cried out to the Lord in distress, as we've seen even times before. And in response, what does God do? He sends them a prophet. And this prophet reminds the people, Israel, of God's great acts of power in the past for them, great acts of kindness. He delivered them from Egypt. He gave them the land of Canaan. He commanded them as they were in the land, and even before they entered the land, do not fear the gods of the Amorites. But what did the Israelites do? They worshipped the gods of the Amorites. They did not obey God's voice. This is what the prophet said. The prophet didn't say anything about judgment or deliverance. And maybe the people of Israel were wondering, well, what is going to happen now? Will we continue to experience oppression at the hands of the Midianites, or is God going to send a deliverer? And it's in this context that we come to verse 11 of chapter 6, and we have an angel of the Lord. And that angel of the Lord comes and sits underneath a tree. And it seems that he's just sitting there and watching a man as he's threshing his wheat, or whatever type of grain, maybe it's barley, threshing grain. And this man is not threshing on a threshing floor, as would be customary practice, but this man is threshing grain in a wine press, down lower, in hopes that the Midianites won't see what he's doing and come in and seize the grain. And this angel appears to Gideon, the man who's threshing grain, and he makes a proclamation, "The Lord is with thee, thou mighty man of valor." And Gideon replies by asking the angel, "If the Lord is with us, then where are all of his miracles that he did in the past in Egypt that our fathers have told us about?" And Gideon declares, "The Lord has forsaken us. He has delivered us into the hands of the Midianites." And the angel replies by saying, "Go in this thy might, and thou shalt save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have not I sent thee?" And how does Gideon respond? "Who am I to save Israel? My family's poor. I'm the least in my father's house." Now Gideon, after we have this conversation, he wants to know for sure that this one talking with him is actually an authoritative individual. And so he asks for a sign, and involved in the sign is Gideon preparing a meal of sorts, a sacrifice, an offering, we could say. Perhaps offering is the best word for it. And we have an offering. We have a kid, a young goat that has been slaughtered and prepared. We have unleavened bread. We have broth from that prepared kid, the baby, the young goat. And the angel tells Gideon to put the offering, the meat and the bread, on a rock and to pour the broth over it. And what does the angel do? He puts forth his staff, and from that rock comes fire and devours the offering. It consumes it. And with this, the angel disappears. And what does Gideon respond by doing? He realized, I've seen the angel of the Lord, and he's afraid he's going to die. The Lord assured him, though, don't fear, you will not die. And after that, Gideon builds an altar to the Lord, and he calls it Jehovah Shalom, the Lord is peace. And it's in this context that we pick up with verses 25 down through 40 of Judges chapter 6. And we're reminded afresh in this passage, our God is a jealous God. Our God demands that his people worship him and him alone. He demands full commitment. There's no competition allowed. It's for this reason that God instructs Gideon as he does in these verses, verses 25 and following. Notice what we read. And it came to pass that same night that the Lord said unto him, take thy father's young bullock, even the second bullock of 7 years old, and throw down the altar of Baal that thy father hath, and cut down the grove that is by it, and build an altar unto the Lord thy God upon the top of this rock in the ordered place, and take the second bullock and offer a burnt sacrifice with the wood of the grove which thou shalt cut down. Then Gideon took 10 men of his servants and did as the Lord had said unto him. And so it was, because he feared his father's household and the men of the city, that he could not do it by day, that he did it by night. On the very night after which Gideon had presented that offering to the Lord, that offering that was accepted by fire, on that very night after Gideon had done this, the Lord gave a message to Gideon. It was a message that demanded commitment from him, a message that demanded action from God's chosen deliverer. And the Lord instructed Gideon to take a certain bull of his father's and to tear down his father's altar of Baal. Now, before we go any further, there is a little bit of discussion around this passage. Is there one bull or is there two bulls? We read about a second bull. So if there's a second bull, it makes us think, well, there's a first bull. And from the King James, the way it translates, it looks like there's one bull, but there may be two very well, a young bullock, and then that second bull that was 7 years old. And you may wonder, well, did Gideon demolish the altar and tear down the Asherah pole and that with one of the bulls, and then with the other bull, he had the offering, he killed that bull and the second bull and then offered it. Either way, we have a bull that was Gideon's father's. And with Gideon's father's own bull, Gideon was instructed to tear down the altar to Baal that was on his own father's property. We just want to let this sink in. What is God calling Gideon to do here? Notice this is his father's altar of Baal. So Baal worship apparently was adopted and promoted by his father, and you'd think Gideon was influenced by that as well. Of course, Gideon didn't necessarily have to worship Baal. He could have been the one that refused to do so. But as we'll see very soon, later on in the passage, the whole area was committed to Baal worship. And what is God instructing Gideon to do? Take your father's bull, tear down your father's Baal altar, and the Asherah pole that is by it. Do this. This is what you must do. In the King James, that Asherah pole, what I'm referring to as Asherah pole, is called a grove. I believe it's an Asherah pole, so it would be a piece of wood that would have been carved in such a way. It was an idol representing, or they maybe they identified that with the goddess Asherah. Would have been worshipped. And that pole was to be cut down. And we find that the wood from that cut down Asherah pole was to be the fuel for the sacrifice that God would accept at Gideon's hand, a sacrifice to the true God. So think of the magnitude of this task that God is asking Gideon to perform. So it involved work. And notice he took 10 of his own servants later on in verse 27. But it involved work to tear down that altar, to cut down the Asherah pole. But also it involved destroying a sacred site. And this is a site that was maintained by his own father. It was probably owned by his own father. So this is no easy task by any means for Gideon. But this is what must be done. You see, God is a jealous God. And if God is going to deliver his people, and he is going to deliver his people, but something must happen at home first. What needs to happen at home first at Gideon's own home? The Baal altar must be done away with. The Asherah pole must be cut down and burnt. and an altar to the true and the living God must be erected, and worship must be done at this place. Worship of the true God. See, Israel at this time had embraced the worship of false gods. And this is why they were under the oppression of the Midianites, because of their rebellion, their lack of faithfulness to the true God. But this practice of Israel is not just a distant reality, like often this faraway city, Israel is committing idolatry. No, it's in Gideon's own front yard or backyard, in his own homeland, in his own home. And this idolatry is an affront to God. It's disloyalty. It's rebellion. And if Gideon was to be God's chosen deliverer, then the first thing he needs to do is get rid of the idolatry there at his own father's house. The idols must go. Baal's altar must be destroyed. And in place of the destroyed altar, there needs to be a new altar, an altar to the true and the living God. So this is quite the assignment that God gave to Gideon. It was an act of commitment. Well, what would his father think? Maybe that's what you'd be wondering. And he definitely was thinking about, well, what are the men of the city going to think? How are they going to respond? But none of that mattered because God said, this is what you must do, and Gideon must respond with commitment, with action. The Lord alone is God. He is the true God. He's a jealous God. There are none others like him. God alone must be worshipped. And God gives the command, destroy what is false, build what is true, worship me alone. Now Gideon, in the previous verses of this passage, we realize he's quite reluctant. He's rather hesitant. You might think, well, this is going to play out in response to what God tells him to do now. But there are no objections made. Gideon does as God tells him. Now he goes out that very night. He obeys the Lord. He takes 10 of the servants. And he does the required task. Notice, too, he's afraid of the men of the city. Okay? But he still obeyed. Okay? He did it at night because he's afraid of the men of the city. And as we see later on in this passage, he had good reason for fear because the men come morning time, they're quite agitated. Somebody has torn down our Baal altar. Somebody's hacked up the Asherah pole, you know. So Gideon realized, my life is probably going to be in danger, or I'm going to be stopped if I do it by day, so I'm going to do it by night. He was fearful, but yet he obeyed God. God is jealous. He put forth the demand, get rid of the false worship, and Gideon complies by tearing down the Baal altar, cutting down the Asherah pole. And he builds an altar to God and sacrifices thereon. God alone is God. He stands without equal, and Gideon's action here demonstrates that quite clearly. Now, the people of that town, their hearts were still bonded to Baal and to Asherah, but Gideon is taking action on behalf of the jealous God. Well, we come to verses 28 and 29. We see that Gideon had good reason to be afraid of the men of the city. And when the men of the city arose early in the morning, behold, the altar of Baal was cast down, and the grove was cut down that was by it, and the second bullock was offered upon the altar that was built. And they said one to another, who hath done this thing? And when they inquired and asked, they said, Gideon the son of Joash hath done this thing. What's the situation here? Gideon was talking to the angel of the Lord, and the circumstance was he was threshing wheat in the winepress. Well, why is that the case? Because of the oppression of the Midianites. 7 years so far, oppressed by the Midianites. Well, why were the Midianites there? Because the Israelites had they had regressed. They were no longer worshiping the true God. They were worshiping false gods. This is why the Midianites were here. Well, we see how bad things are, even at verses 28 and 29. The men of the city here, Ophrah, are so committed to Baal worship, and they're so angry, they're going to ask for justice to be done, at least justice according to their way of thinking. So if there's any doubt about God's justice and God's holiness in sending the Midianites to oppress Israel, it should be settled by just reading verses 28 and 29 and the following verses. The men of the city were committed to worship Baal and Asherah, they weren't committed to worship the true God. They thought little about the God who had redeemed them from Egypt. They thought little about the God who had given them this land. They thought highly of Baal and Asherah. These are the important ones. Now, Gideon had spent, no doubt, the whole night demolishing the Baal altar, destroying the Asherah pole, building a true altar to worship God in a rightful way. And come morning, and early in the morning, the men wake up, they see what had happened, and what a commotion must have spread like wildfire throughout that city. The people were angry. They were terribly angry. And immediately there's this demand, who has done this thing? Who has torn down our Baal altar? Who has cut down the Asherah pole? The one who has done this must be found, and he must be punished. And it comes back, Gideon is the one who has done this. Gideon, the son of Joash, has done this deed. Verse 30, then the men of the city said unto Joash, bring out thy son, that he may die, because he hath cast down the altar of Baal, and because he hath cut down the grove that was by it. The culprit had been found. And in their eyes, the eyes of these Baal worshippers, Gideon was a criminal. He was a criminal worthy of death. And you'd think in their anger they would all immediately seize Gideon and go about their business of putting him to death. But you realize Gideon was living at home. And so the authority there was not Gideon. It wasn't the townspeople. It was Gideon's father, Joash. And so the people, keeping things in order, I suppose, to a certain extent, they went to the one in power here at this place. And they went to Joash, Gideon's father. And Joash needs to give the final okay as to whether they do away with Gideon or not. And so they address Joash. They demand his death, the death of Gideon. Gideon had destroyed Baal's altar. He'd hewed down that Asherah pole. He must pay the price. All we need is your okay, Joash. Can we do away with your son for this atrocious act? May we put him to death. And how does Joash respond? Verse 31, and Joash said unto all that stood against him, will ye plead for Baal? Will ye save him? He that will plead for him, let him be put to death while it is yet morning. If he be a god, let him plead for himself, because one hath cast down his altar. Now how surprised the townspeople must have been as Joash comes back with this response. Keep in mind, whose Baal altar was this? It was Joash's Baal altar. So surely the townspeople were thinking, well, Joash will be all in favor of having a rightful punishment, according to their way of thinking, a rightful punishment to this one who has destroyed Baal's altar and hewed down the Asherah pole. Surely he will agree with us. So Joash, the one who erected the Baal altar, perhaps, at least he's the one that owns it, he put up that Asherah pole, no doubt. He owned the land where the sacred site was, the site devoted to false worship of a false god. Surely Joash would be in favor of punishing the one who has done this. But keep in mind, it was Joash's son who had done this atrocious deed. Now keep in mind, it wasn't an atrocious deed. But according to the townspeople, it was an atrocious deed. And Joash seems like he's thinking pretty straight here, because he has love for his son above his love for Baal, if indeed he was loving Baal at this point in time in his life. We might hope that Joash had come to his senses and now he was loving God instead of loving Baal. We can't say that for sure, but at least we know Joash was more concerned about his son than he was about the altar of Baal and the Asherah pole. And Joash was in no mood to defend Baal and Asherah and to kill his own son for the honor of Baal and Asherah. So instead of sending his, or presenting his son to these angry men, he rebuked them. Will you plead for Baal? Will you contend for him? Will you deliver him? Now, if anyone dares to do such a thing as far as contending for Baal, if anybody puts my son to death, let him be put to death. There's going to be none of this. Or maybe even if there was anyone that was defending Baal vocally, maybe Joash's reply was, you should be put to death. And indeed, according to the law of Moses, that's what should have happened. But Joash said something that is quite profound. If Baal indeed is God, let Baal defend his own honor, because someone has destroyed his altar. See how Joash, even though this was his altar, this Baal altar, he was wise, he was courageous. It seems as if he almost has a spiritual awakening here. And hopefully he did. But at least he's speaking sensibly about the matter. If Baal is God, let him defend himself. But no one is going to kill his son Gideon for destroying Baal's altar. Well, did Baal strike Gideon dead? What power did Baal have to defend himself or to contend for himself? And that day, Gideon was still alive. The following day, Gideon was still alive. Baal was powerless to do anything against Gideon. Baal did not contend for himself. And what does that show? Baal wasn't really a god at all, was he? he was powerless. This was the state of things in the town of Ophrah. And we might wonder in our minds, well, why does God even bother delivering a people like this? A people who is so devoted to worshiping Baal and Asherah, demanding the death of someone who has torn down this false altar, altar of a false god, wanting to put to death those who are doing what is right. Things are turned upside down. Everything, those things that should have been called good are called bad, and the things that are called bad, that should have been called bad, are called good. Things were turned around. But yet we see God's mercy. We see God's love and compassion for his people, even though they were very stubborn and rebellious and misguided. Now with verse 32, we realize that with his courageous action, Gideon received a new name. Therefore, on that day, he called him Jerubbabel, saying, let Baal plead against him, or let him contend against him, because he hath thrown down his altar. Here's the new name for Gideon. Let Baal fight with him. Gideon had attacked Baal. Baal could fight against Gideon if he wanted, but surely, on this day, Gideon won the victory against Baal. Baal had been defeated. Now, so far in our passage, would you agree with me, we see a very clear depiction, God is a jealous God. He's not going to put up with any competition. Destroy the Baal altar, cut down the Asherah pole. Now we're going to be seeing in the verses to follow, yes, God is forbearing. He is patient, he is long-suffering. And even we've already seen that too. We see his long-suffering nature, even with the idolatry of the wicked people of Ophrah. But look at verses 33 and following. We'll see God's forbearance specifically with Gideon. Then all the Midianites and the Amalekites and the children of the east were gathered together and went over and pitched in the valley of Jezreel. But the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon, and he blew a trumpet, and Abiezer was gathered after him. And he sent messengers throughout all Manasseh, who also was gathered after him. And he sent messengers unto Asher and unto Zebulun and unto Naphtali, and they came up to meet them. Now, our attention is drawn back to the big picture of what's going on during Gideon's day. No longer are we focused on the local happenings in this town of Ophrah, where Gideon lived and his father and the townspeople here. Now, our attention is drawn back to the stark reality of what has been troubling Israel for years and years. The Midianites and their allies, the Amalekites and the children of the east, have made an incursion across the river. And they're gathered together now, and they're pitched with their tents in the valley of Jezreel, no doubt scattered like grasshoppers upon the land. And in years past, the Midianites had had no opposition against their incursion. But this time, things were going to be far different. This time, Israel had a deliverer in its midst. And verse 34 is so very important because we read here, the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon. As Gideon delivered God's people, he would not do so on his own strength. He would do so as he's empowered by the Spirit of God. And what is his first action here as the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon? And very literally, it's the Spirit of the Lord clothed Gideon. But God's enabling Gideon through his Spirit. And anything great Gideon would do, it's because the Spirit came upon him. And so with the Spirit coming upon him now, Gideon calls the people to action. First of all, he blows the trumpet, and his own people of Abiezer come to him. And with such a response, Gideon probably was encouraged, and so he sent messengers to the further reaches of his own tribe, Manasseh. And Manasseh also gathers to him to fight for his cause against the Midianites. And then Gideon sends messengers even further out to the tribes of Asher and Zebulun and Naphtali. And again, men come from these places. They're behind Gideon. They're supporting him. And now you might expect to read, well, Gideon goes to war with all these men and have the victory over the Midianites. The Spirit of God is upon Gideon. Things are going to go so much better now. Gideon will be a courageous warrior now, a mighty warrior, not afraid of the Midianites in the slightest. But we don't find that exactly right now, do we? We come to verses 36 and following. And in these verses, we see that the same God who was so jealous, who had a vengeance to defend his own honor and his own name, this God is also a God who is very forbearing. He puts up with very much from his own. Look at verses 36 down through 38. And Gideon said unto God, if thou wilt save Israel by mine hand, as thou hast said, behold, I will put a fleece of wool on the floor, And if the dew be on the fleece only, and it be dry upon all the earth beside, then shall I know that thou wilt save Israel by mine hand, as thou hast said. And it was so, for he rose up early on the morrow, and thrust the fleece together, and wringed the dew out of the fleece, a bowl full of water. Now earlier, Gideon had asked God for a sign, to make sure that he was talking with somebody who was indeed an authoritative figure here. Now he's asking God for another sign. Before he was asking to want to make sure that he knew who was speaking to him, now he's wanting confirmation that what God said is indeed what he's going to do. Is God going to follow through with his word? Now, is there any sign that should be required for such a thing? It should be accepted. It should be, you know, God's people should trust God that God will keep his word. But Gideon needed a sign. He was unsure. He was hesitant. He was doubting, it appears. Would God really deliver Israel by his own hand? Will God use Gideon to do this great thing? And the sign that Gideon proposes is quite well known to us. We have the fleece of wool. So Gideon would put this fleece of wool on the floor, and if on the following morning the ground is dry and the fleece is wet, then Gideon would know that God indeed is going to keep his word. He will do as he said he would. Now Gideon went ahead with his plan. He put the fleece out. The next morning, what did he find? The ground was wet or dry. What was it? The ground was dry, right? And the fleece was wet. It was so wet, as he wrung it out, he filled up a bowl of water. God had made it very clear to Gideon. He had answered his sign, his request. He had done the sign. And surely Gideon now would be ready to go against the Midianites. But then perhaps Gideon started thinking, the sign that I asked God for wasn't really all that difficult, was it? Because in Gideon's mind, maybe he realized, well, it's natural for a fleece of wool to collect water. So did God really send this sign? Maybe he was thinking that. I need to ask God for another sign, a sign that's far more difficult, so I know for sure God is going to keep his word. It seems that Gideon is still unconvinced, even though God gave him the first sign. And so we read now in verses 39 and 40, "And Gideon said unto God, Let not thine anger be hot against me, and I will speak but this once. Let me prove, I pray thee, but this once with the fleece. Let it now be dry only upon the fleece, and upon all the ground let there be dew. And God did so that night, for it was dry upon the fleece only, and there was dew on all the ground." I think Gideon realized that what he was doing was not the proper thing to do. Okay? He realized that in asking God for a second sign, God may very well become angry with him. Maybe his patience runs short with this second sign. Let not thine anger be hot against me. But Gideon had his doubts. He had his hesitancy. He was questioning, is God going to work through me as he has promised? I need further confirmation. That's what Gideon was thinking. And this time Gideon asks for something that is far more difficult, at least from our perspective and from Gideon's perspective. Let the fleece be dry, but the ground around it be wet with dew. And that following morning, what did Gideon find? It was just as he had asked. The fleece was dry. The ground was wet with dew. Have you ever wondered why Gideon asked for this specific sign with the fleece and the dew and either wet or dry? You know, was there any particular reason? Perhaps it's because Gideon had in the back of his mind, I have just made an affront against Baal. And Baal, I've torn down his altar. Do you realize what type of a god Baal was thought to be? He was the storm god. He is the god who sent the rain, who also would have sent the dew. Was Gideon perhaps thinking, is Baal going to contend against me? Is he going to fight against me? And is the god that I am called by, Yahweh the Lord, is he greater than Baal? Will he protect me? Is that what it was going through his mind? Perhaps it is. Who is in control of the dew? And with this sign, Gideon comes to realize the Lord, the true and the living God, is the one in control of the dew. He's the one that sends this or holds it back. So here is Gideon asking God not to do just one sign, but two signs, so that his doubts would be put to rest. Gideon was unsure if God could be trusted, if God would indeed keep his promises. He needed reassurance that Gideon, he is the man to deliver Israel. Now you remember earlier what we read, the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon. you'd think, surely if the Spirit of the Lord is upon someone, then they won't be acting like Gideon acts, right? All doubts would be put away if the Spirit of the Lord is upon someone. But from this we understand that the Spirit of the Lord does not take away every human weakness or every sin that a person may commit. The Spirit of the Lord did not take away Gideon's weaknesses and his doubts and his hesitancy. The Spirit of the Lord did not make Gideon sinless, but the Spirit of the Lord did empower him and enable him to do God's work of deliverance, even with Gideon's shortcomings and his doubts and his hesitancies. These closing verses of chapter 6, we see how forbearing and long-suffering, and even as Gideon would phrase it, slow to anger, we see how God is a forbearing God. He puts up with much from his people. And how many doubts, how much hesitancy Gideon had, and God put up with all of those, and God was very compassionate and gracious to give him signs to reassure him that indeed I will keep my word. We should be thankful today as we think about our own lives, our own day and age. Aren't you thankful that God is a God who is forbearing and patient and slow to anger? We might be hard on Gideon, thinking, Gideon, you shouldn't have been like that. You should have trusted the Lord. You shouldn't have doubted. You shouldn't have been so hesitant. But where would we be at if God called us to do such a thing? Gideon realized God is forbearing. He is gracious. And we today, we should realize the same, and we should be so thankful for it. We are so weak. We have so many failures. And God does so much for us even when we don't deserve it. God gives us help. He reassures us in so many ways. Even when, really, we shouldn't need that reassurance, God still reassures us so many times. He calms our fears. He lays to rest our doubts so many times. Yes, we may be prone to judge Gideon. Yes, he was hesitant and he was doubtful when he shouldn't have been. But so many times we may be like just like Gideon or even worse than him. Our God is a forbearing God and we're thankful for that. We should be. We should be thankful as well. What we saw earlier in the passage, our God is a jealous God. He will put up with no competition. And we may think, well, God allows idolatry, and he has allowed idolatry, but there again we see the coupling together of God's patience and slowness to anger along with his jealousy. But one day, what's going to happen? One day God is going to be the sole authority, the sole recognized God, and all other competition is going to be done away with, right? We realize that will happen one day. But yet God is even forbearing right now, even with idolaters and sinners of all sorts, with the lost, desiring for them to come to know Jesus. He is forbearing, but he is still jealous. We should be thankful for both of these attributes of our God. What awe and respect God demands. What reverent fear we should be giving our God. He allows no competition. He is a consuming fire. He demands soul commitment and soul worship from his people. Our God is jealous. Our God is forbearing and patient. This is what our God is like. And we could add many more characteristics to our description of God, but we focused on these two today. May we worship this God. May we serve him faithfully. May we praise him and give him thanks. He alone is the jealous and forbearing God. May we bow down and worship him today. Heavenly Father, we thank you for Gideon. Yes, we may be hard on him at times in our own minds, thinking that he should not have been so doubtful or hesitant. He should not have put you to the test, demanding signs or asking for signs. But yet we realize you are very forbearing with him, slow to anger. We thank you that Gideon was responsive to your command to tear down the Baal altar, even when it was his father's own Baal altar. He was obedient to the command to cut down the Asherah pole. Yes, he was fearful of the men of the city, but yet he still obeyed, even though he did it by night. So we thank you for Gideon's good example of obedience in that case. So many things we can learn, in so many ways we can identify with Gideon, even in his hesitancy and doubt. So we thank you today. You are a jealous God. You are a forbearing God. Help us to serve you faithfully. Thank you for putting up with our weaknesses. Thank you for your grace that even enables us and empowers us. And our prayer is we want to be more like Jesus. We want to serve you faithfully. So again, we thank you tonight for all that we've learned from Gideon and all that we learn about you from Gideon. So we pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.